I have a tattoo of a butterfly. But why a butterfly? Well, butterflies spend the beginning part of their lives trying to figure out who they are. They work hard, and then they make a transformation into the beautiful creatures that they were meant to be. I heard a great tattoo story the other day from a company that I get my favorite socks from, too. Bombas. Bombas started when two guys, Randy and Dave, heard that socks were the number one requested clothing item in homeless shelters. For every pair of socks Bombas sells, they donate a pair to those in need. Dave promised Randy he'd get a Bombas logo tattoo when they donated a million pair of socks. He thought it would take 10 years, but it only took 2.5. And now Dave has a Bombas tattoo and a great story to tell about it. I love everything about Bombas socks, from the cuteness to the comfort, and I can't recommend them enough. So, for the best socks in the history of feet, visit bombas.com/actual today, and you'll get an additional 20% off your first purchase. That's Bombas, bombas.com/actual for 20% off. bombas.com/actual.
I don't want to hold on to the grudges and things. I just want change. I can be mad and angry about the situation, you know, that occurred, or I can be a person that's be able to speak about it. In this situation right here, this platform that you're giving me to put the word out to people, those people that may be on those juries, those people that are in the government, lawyers, attorneys that are out there to know and understand what's going on and the possibilities that people can get put in this situation. It's, I think that's the best way that I can deal with the situation is by giving back and maybe helping save someone else's life from having to go through what I went through.
Hi, this is Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast dedicated to spreading awareness of wrongful conviction. Today, you're in for a special treat. Not only are we going to speak with an exoneree, but also two attorneys. This episode is going to have three advertisements and then two trailers at the end for independent podcasts. Those aren't ads. No money is changing hands. I just want to help connect you to great podcasts. I've been hearing so many stories in the news lately about people like Adnan or Brendan or Steven or Richard. These men's stories have been told and shown to us repeatedly. On this show, Actual Innocence, we've talked to countless people who have been exonerated. The combination of those two things have inspired this episode. When we listen to the stories of people who have been the victim of faulty justice, I want to know. I want to answer the questions. Are these cases the outliers? Or is this the norm? After the break, I'll introduce you to the people who are going to attempt to help me answer this question. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? ZipRecruiter is different because you can post your job to 100 plus sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual. That's ZipRecruiter.com/actual. One more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/actual. Today's panelists consist of two attorneys, Rachel Kamens and Erica Souter. Both of these women work on post-conviction cases in Maryland and have been involved in some of the high-profile cases that I mentioned before. So I'm going to have them introduce themselves. So Rachel, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name's Rachel Kamens. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I do almost exclusively post-conviction and appellate work. For the first half of my career, which has been about 25 years long now, I was an appellate prosecutor for the Attorney General's Office in Maryland. Then I crossed over to the defense side in 2004, and I have been representing defendants who are incarcerated, many of whom, most of whom probably are serving life sentences, and those who are not serving life sentences are serving incredibly long sentences. And my job is to try to find some way to go back and undo what has happened, mostly looking for issues that will grant a defendant a new trial. Oftentimes, we're simply trying to get a lower sentence for the person. That is the focus of my practice now.
And you've kind of had some podcast experience lately too, huh?
You can't tell from how goofy I sound when I'm talking in these recordings, but yes, I have a little bit of podcast experience now, thanks to you.
And Erica, can you tell us more about yourself?
So my name's Erica Suter. I've been practicing for about 14 years and focused on what I do now for about a little over nine years. So Rachel and I and my practice are very similar. I have a solo practice, and I deal with basically anything after you were convicted. So appeals, post-convictions, and other things, petitions for writ of actual innocence or modifications. So some of my cases involve clients who are actually innocent, and many of my cases involve some sort of error, whether the attorney committed some sort of mistake or on appeal, the court made some sort of mistake, but trying to go back and take another bite at the apple and help my clients to either have a lower sentence or to get out of prison.
So we have one more panelist, and I want to thank you, Malcolm, for waiting so patiently. Malcolm is an exoneree that I was able to meet at the Innocence Conference. If you have not heard that episode, you're going to want to, because he is quite the character. But I invited Malcolm because I thought, who better to help us understand the issues in the justice system than someone who has been a witness to its failure? So, Malcolm, I know you're going to be on an episode of Actual Innocence coming up soon, but can you tell us a little bit about your situation now, about what happened to you?
Well, hello. I'm Malcolm Scott. Yes, actually, in 1994, I was arrested, and in 1995, I was convicted and sentenced to life plus 170 years for a murder case I had absolutely nothing to do with. I was just exonerated in 2016, May the 9th, and so I'm out free now after almost 22 years, basically.
Well, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about your trial. So at your trial, did you retain an attorney? Or was your attorney a public defender?
My attorney was a public defender. They had both me and my co-defendant under the same public defender at first. And then I guess, I don't know if it was a conflict of interest or something, they wanted to separate us. And so they called in another guy. I don't think he was actually a public defender, but he was paid by the state. And he came in and took over my side of the case.
And did you have a jury trial?
It was a jury trial.
We've met, right? You know what I look like?
Yeah.
Did your jury look like you? Did they look like me? Or were they a mix?
They looked like you.
They look like me?
Okay. They look like you. It was not even close to a mix.
And what about ages? I mean, I think that we are fairly close in age, but how do you think the ages in your jury were? Were they close to you?
Oh, no, they were older people, you know, like, basically, I feel like they were a lot older people, and I was 17 years old at the time, you know, so they were much older to me, you know, and so it was definitely nobody that you could just consider my peers, unless I was just hanging out with my grandpa or something all the time. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I wouldn't consider these my peers. But yeah.
My next question to you is going to be, how old were you when you were arrested and tried? Like, what was your age?
I was 17 years old. Yeah, I was 17 years old when I got arrested in 1994, September 11th.
And you were tried as an adult?
Yes, I was tried in as an adult. After I stayed in the county for, I think it was a little over a year, we finally went to trial. By that time, I was 18. But they had already charged us as adults before we even went to trial and turned 18.
So, Erica, I'm going to ask you a question. In your experience, how many post-conviction clients, how many clients in prison have you represented that were arrested and tried as adults that were, in fact, not really adults?
Surprisingly common, I would say, and it is difficult to break down a statistic, but certainly I can think of numerous cases where my clients were 15, and then on top of that, many, many cases where my clients were 17 and charged and tried as adults and given adult sentences. So you think about like a 15-year-old kid going off and being incarcerated in prison with adults, and it's pretty scary stuff.
Well, what about you, Rachel? Do you know what percentage of your clients you think might have been children when they were tried as adults?
A lot. I don't know percentage. I can't even give you anything more specific than a lot. But I mean, as I'm thinking about the answer to your question, I can come up with many of my clients whose files are currently in my office. So active cases of mine where they were as young as 15. I'm actually lying. I had just last month went to court with somebody who had been 14.
Wow.
When he was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years. And I have had a handful of 15-year-olds and quite a lot of 16 and 17-year-olds convicted of murder and sentenced to life or incredibly long sentences. So, I mean, it's pretty common. They were all tried as adults. The ones who were on the younger end often had hearings that are called waiver hearings to determine whether they're going to be retained in juvenile court or advanced to adult court. But in all the cases that I have, they, by definition, because they're incarcerated now serving life sentences, they were obviously tried in adult court.
Wow.
So yeah, it's pretty common in my caseload alone. So I'm sure that's representative of what's out there in the general population.
Malcolm, you're okay. Tell me if it's not okay to say this, but you're around 30 right now, right?
No.
No. How old?
I'm way past 30. I'm 40.
You're 40. Oh, I am so sorry.
Yeah.
Man, you're old. How did I miss that? No.
Well, 40 is the new 30, though.
That's true. People think I'm 12, so, you know.
That's a good answer.
Okay, so you're 40, Malcolm. Your maturity right now, how do you feel like compares to your maturity when you were 17?
Well, it's definitely a major difference. You know, of course, I went in at 17. I was a kid, obviously. But I think the most difficult part about that situation is I had to learn to become a man from inside a prison. You know what I mean? So that was a difficult situation, right? So I had to basically more or less educate myself and things like that.
Well, and when you were 17, did you feel like an adult? Because when I was 17, I sometimes still don't feel like an adult. So did you feel like an adult, or do you feel like you were kind of still at that age where you wanted some adult guidance, like people helping you and telling you what to do?
Well, I mean, I was not an adult, obviously, but I feel like being put in that situation, I was forced to have to grow up fast. You know what I mean? I couldn't be a kid inside of a adult prison. That would not be smart of me at all. So I had to step up and basically, like they say, man up and, you know, hold my own in that type of situation. Because they, you know, in that place, you know, they prey on the weak.
Do you think that 40-year-old Malcolm would have reacted the same at the trial as 17-year-old Malcolm did?
Oh, no, probably not. Me now, I think, and the person that I am at this point in life, like, it would be very, very difficult for me to even see myself in that type of situation. But if it was to occur, like, I don't know, I would still be upset and devastated just to know that I was incarcerated for something I didn't do. So I think as far as age, it doesn't matter. It's wrong, it's wrong. You know, if you convict them at 14 or if you convict a man at 50, I mean, if you wrongfully do this to a person and take their life, it's just wrong, you know, and no matter what age it is.
Do you think that a person with more maturity is better able to help in their own defense just because they've had more life experience?
I mean, yes, yeah, some could. You know, some could probably, you know, they'd have, you know, like you said, more maturity, and they'd have more education to be able to fight better. And they'd probably even be more established in life. And so, I mean, I think it would be a lot of probably differences, you know, in the situation and how they would handle it, you know, in those different ages.
Can I tell you something?
What's that?
You're a rock star. You've been out of prison for a little over a year, and you spent most of your adult life there, and you're one of the nicest, most respectful people I know, and I appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, I try to carry myself in that manner. Just, I mean, it's just who I am, though. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm thankful, I'm happy, I'm blessed in life. So that's how I live, you know, and that's how I treat other people. And so, you know, I don't want to hold on to the grudges and things. I just want change. You know what I mean? Like, I can be mad and angry about the situation, you know, that occurred, or I can be a person that's be able to speak about it in this situation right here, this platform that you're giving me, to put the word out to people, you know, those people that may be on those juries, you know, the people that are in the government, lawyers, you know, attorneys that are out there to know and understand what's going on and the possibilities that people can get, you know, put in this situation, you know. And so it's, I think that's the best way, you know, that I can deal with the situation is by giving back and maybe helping save someone else's life from having to go through what I went through.
I love it. You've chosen advocacy over anger. I think it's amazing. Erica, have you ever worked with a client that you think that was so young when they were convicted that they couldn't possibly have aided in their own defense?
I think so, yeah. I'm thinking, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking of a couple of different cases. But one of the issues, I had a client who pled guilty when he was 15 years old to first-degree murder. And you think about, you know, at 15 years old, a child's not allowed to make decisions for themselves about where they want to go to school. They can't drive a car, but they're making that decision as to whether or not to accept a plea and sort of all of the fallout that comes with that, or whether or not to testify. And ultimately, it's their decision. And I think if we as a society don't view a child as mature enough to make decisions about whether or not they go to school or other sort of fundamental decisions, then the idea of it, those are difficult decisions for adults to make and for educated adults to make. So, you know, I can think of plenty of cases where a child wasn't in a good position to understand the implications of what was happening.
Rachel, have you ever had a client that you thought was so young that they didn't know what was happening and that's the reason that they're where they are?
I have. It's very common to see a kid basically go along with whatever the attorney tells him to do, particularly considering most criminal trials end in guilty pleas. When you talk to somebody who pled guilty 10, 20, 30 years ago, and they're trying to do a post-conviction at this point, it's a common refrain to hear them say, "Yeah, I had absolutely no idea what the judge was saying to me. It was all a bunch of, you know, gobbledygook. Do you understand this? Do you understand that? You have this right. You're giving up that right. These are the consequences of your pleading guilty." It's very, very difficult language to understand for a layperson in general. There's no way a child of that age, you know, early 20s even, depending on whether there's any familiarity with the criminal justice system, it would be hard to understand a lot of that. So what we hear them say this many years later is I did not know what was going on. I did not know what anybody meant by anything they were saying, but my lawyer said, just nod your head and say yes when the judge asks you, do you know what you're doing? Do you understand what you're doing? And, you know, as a practical matter, there's no way that they could have. And in fact, most of the time they didn't, but they were just, you know, they didn't have the faculties to challenge any of it. They were scared. They were uneducated. They were uninformed about the process. So, you know, they wind up pleading guilty and giving up their entire life to sit in jail forever.
Malcolm, did you feel like pressure to just do what your attorney asked you to do?
I mean, my attorney, like, I don't know, like I was trying to share like witnesses. I had alibi witnesses, you know what I mean? Like real solid alibi witnesses that I was trying to get him to speak to and things like that. And it was like, he just seemed like he didn't really even take me serious. And he never even called the witnesses up there to testify on my behalf. So, you know, the connection between me and my attorney was basically, you know, not even there. It was absent.
Like he was going through the motions.
Yeah, it was just basically like he was just going through the motions. You know, it wasn't, I don't even think he even considered that, you know, it was somebody's life, you know, being about to be taken for something I didn't have anything to do with. Like, I'm not even sure he even believed that I was innocent. So, you know, he definitely did. I mean, I don't feel like he even fought for me like he felt like I was innocent or even, it was just, you know, because I felt like there was so much stronger evidence there in our behalf and he never even utilized it. And even then at a young age, I could see that. And even more on down the years, I could see so much more. And it was just like, wow, you know.
Do you think 40-year-old Malcolm would have stood up to him?
I mean, I think 40-year-old Malcolm would have made some more wiser decisions and probably got rid of him. You know, maybe spoke to the judge about getting a different attorney. You know, I would have knew how to, you know, file some type of paperwork to ask for a different attorney and put myself in a much better position because, you know, he definitely didn't.
So I've been doing some research on your case and there was some, you can't see it, but I'm making quotes with my fingers. Okay. Witnesses in your trial. Yeah. Can you tell me about that?
Oh yeah. We had a couple of false witnesses to get up there and testify on us.
So false meaning that they were lying about what happened?
Yeah. Lied about what was going on. Yeah. Same ones that basically later came back and recanted and admitted that they never even saw us from the beginning. I mean, because, I mean, in the situation, I know, like you said, you did some research, so you knew that they said the car came by with tinted windows and just drove by shooting, and yet these people are standing up here on the stand saying, yeah, I seen this guy's face clearly, it was him. And then, you know, so...
Through the tinted window?
Yeah, through the tinted window. One guy even got shot from behind. Like, he got shot from behind, directly from behind. So, and yet he said he seen me in the car. You know what I mean? Like, it was just crazy. But, like, you know, it just seems impossible. Like, how can you... I mean, he completely described the gun and the caliber of gun and everything to a T. Like, somebody fed him all this information. And it's like impossible. How do you possibly see that at 3 o'clock in the morning through some tinted windows? Like, so it was just preposterous witnesses getting up there saying things that any logical person really would have been like, how could you do that? How could you see that? You know, they would question that.
What benefit was there to that witness? Like, what was their motivation for lying about you?
Oh, they had charges on them themselves. They had, I think, a couple of shooting cases and some other charges. They were when they brought them into the courtroom, they were actually handcuffed because they were in the county jail themselves, you know, on cases, on charges. And right after their testimony against us, yeah, their charges got dropped and they were back out on the streets.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sure if you look in your research, you can see that too. That right after those testimonies, they were freed of their charges.
I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it is by far the easiest way I found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I actually just use SeatGeek to buy tickets to my favorite musical. The app is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get 20% off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the app and enter promo code CONVICTED today. That's promo code CONVICTED for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. So, Rachel, I know that you do post-conviction work, and do you frequently see or hear that witnesses were incentivized to testify against your clients?
Yes, quite often. Quite often. It's a tactic, certainly, that the prosecution uses, that the police use on a regular basis to make their case. And it's not always that the witness is being fed something, you know, entirely false, but certainly even the incentive to cooperate can be a big red flag for the defense, even if they're not outright lying. But certainly I've seen cases and had cases where the witnesses were motivated by getting some kind of resolution favorably of their own charges, that were absolutely being fed the information, I know this sounds familiar to a well-known case, being fed information from whole cloth, and other cases where the witness may have actually valid information to share, but certainly wasn't going to come forward with that information were it not for promises in exchange for that information. Promises made either at the initial stages from the police officers or the detectives, or later on from the prosecutor themselves. So yeah, I think that's something we see regularly.
Erica, I'm going to kind of turn this question around on you a little. Have you ever had a client that was that person who testified to get a deal?
Yes. So I can think of two cases that sort of segue, where I had two cases, one where a client was 15 and one where a client was 17. The 15-year-old actually had a juvenile co-defendant, and the 17-year-old had two adult co-defendants, and they testified against their co-defendant, or I can think of a few other cases as well. In these instances, it was for the state to take life without parole off the table. So they had life with parole, which in Maryland at this point in time is functionally life without parole. So yeah, I've had a couple of cases where minors, in fact, have cooperated in order to get a slightly more lenient sentence.
So, Malcolm, when somebody lies to me or about me, I get really mad. And I have never had a lie told about me that made me lose 20 years of my life. So you are this nice, compassionate person, and I just want to know, how do you feel towards these people? How do you feel towards these witnesses that lied?
I mean, honestly, like when I, of course, you know, just like you, I was angry when it was initially happening, you know what I mean? To watch somebody just completely fabricate a story in front of you, and you know that you're innocent. Like, you're looking at them and you're like, wow, how can you completely fabricate this story? I know I didn't have anything to do with this, you know? So, you know, it was hard. And of course, yeah, like any human being, I was very angry and upset about it, you know. But over time and years and like you said, maturity and learning, I mean, you learn to forgive. I mean, you have to. Yeah, not only to free them out of guilt, but to free yourself, because you don't want to sit with that much anger on your mind and in your heart to just build up over years and years and years and years. You know, I mean, it definitely is not going to make your sentence easier, and you'll go through a lot of pain, you know, just holding that anger inside. And so I had to learn to forgive and let go and move forward in life. And instead of sitting and being angry about the problem, I had to utilize that anger and channel it into a positive way and start fighting for my life. You know, I, instead of using that anger to bring me down, I used it to build with and find any and every way that I could to prove my innocence, you know, and contact the people and connect with all the people that I needed to contact with to find a way to get me out of there and allow the truth to be told. So, you know, I mean, a lot of people, they don't do that, and they be angry, and they can end up catching more time in there, and then all hope is gone. For real.
I think that's really admirable of you. You have a really admirable position.
I mean, you have to be if you want your life.
Okay, Erica, I'm going to ask you about the Adnan case. There seems like there are so many different witnesses in that case. There are people who saw Hay before school, after school. You know, they saw Adnan here, Adnan there. How reliable do you think eyewitness testimony actually is?
I think that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable. And there are, in addition to Adnan's case, there's a lot of cases you can think about where, so there's a couple of different kinds of eyewitnesses, right? So we have sometimes people who are facing charges or who are already incarcerated and they're looking to bargain. Let me trade information about this confession that my cellmate gave to me in order to better their sentence. But then you also just have regular free citizens who are providing information. And when you just think about it in terms of, can you tell me where you were a year ago today at 3 o'clock? It's incredibly difficult to pinpoint that in time. And sometimes people want to be helpful. So it's difficult to pinpoint where you are. And sometimes I think people want to be helpful, but the memory is a very malleable thing. And if certain suggestions are made or information is given, you can believe something, even if it's inaccurate. So in Adnan's case, obviously there is the big thing that sort of grabbed everybody's attention is this alibi witness that his attorney did not interview and did not look into. And then there are other people who place him or place her at different places at different times. And I think that it is, eyewitness testimony can be very misleading, very inaccurate. And it's not always that people have, you know, nefarious aims like that. It's not always that somebody's trying to bargain and better their position. It's sometimes that people are simply mistaken. And that is almost scarier than the person who's trying to lie about somebody to better their position. Is also there are people who are good-hearted people who just get it wrong, and somebody can be convicted based on that.
That's actually an excellent point. And I was just going to ask, Rachel, do you think that it is more frequent that a false witness is someone who is trying to better their position, or do you think it's someone whose brain is misremembering? Do you think that there's any kind of data to support that? Or
if there's any data one way or the other, I don't know it. And I'm not even sure that I can say which is more frequent. I just can say that I've experienced in my cases alone, both phenomena for sure. And kind of like what Erica was saying, you know, there's just so much potential for mistake and suggestivity in both remembering things and sort of convincing yourself that you've remembered something some way. And over time, you sort of latch on to that version and you get farther and farther away from what the reality was because your brain has kind of hooked into this particular version of events. Certainly with photo identifications, there's issues with photo arrays, sometimes intentionally or unintentionally, are put together by the police. And depending on what the description was that was given by the witness, the photo array can be very misleading and lead to false identifications. And oftentimes you see in-court identifications being made. And this is a this is a big problem, I think, where the witness is asked, look around the courtroom, do you see the person who did this crime in the courtroom? And the witness will identify the defendant. Number one, the defendant is sitting at the trial table next to the defense attorney and is the only person there who could possibly be that person, but also because oftentimes they've made a photo identification outside of court. So who knows if they're IDing the person in court because they remember seeing a picture of him shown by the police, or whether they're actually recognizing him as the perpetrator of the crime. And I would suggest that it's impossible to know, and quite likely that their ID is tainted by having seen a photograph of that person as opposed to, you know, during the crime in process. So I just think that there are occurrences of both incidents that you asked about.
Getting a good night's sleep is easier said than done, especially if you think you just heard a noise downstairs. Think about it. What do you do in that situation? You could turn on all the lights and keep watch. You could check your kids' beds every hour. You could sleep with one eye open. Or you could rest easy, knowing that your home and family are protected with SimpliSafe. When you install your SimpliSafe home security, you're arming your home with powerful sensors that actually tell you if a door opens or if a window breaks. There's a 105 decibel siren that alerts you at the first sign of trouble. You'll have a dedicated team of security professionals watching over you 24/7, ready to send the police. With SimpliSafe, there's no long-term contracts. Around-the-clock monitoring is only $14.99 a month. So don't spend another night second-guessing your home safety. Get SimpliSafe and get some rest. Go to simplisafe.com/innocence and get a special 10% discount when you order today. That's simplisafe.com/innocence for 10% off your order. simplisafe.com/innocence.
So Malcolm, I was reading, have you seen the write-up about yourself on the Exoneree Registry?
Yeah, I think I did. I've seen that.
So it lists on there that there was misconduct at your trial. And it seemed to me like there was a lot, but I was wondering if you could pinpoint it for me, if you knew exactly which misconduct that they were talking about.
Well, I mean, I believe it was some misconduct by the DA, as well as I think some things by the judge as well. But I think the main thing I think by the DA was they had allowed a witness to get up there and testify against us that basically said, in order to be a certified gang member, you would have to have previous convictions for violent crimes like murders and robberies and things like that. And we were 17-year-old kids with no record whatsoever. And the judge allowed this witness to testify to this in front of this jury to basically give them the perception that, yeah, we've done these type of crimes before. And I mean, to put that type of influence on the jury is, I mean, that's a deal breaker, you know?
I mean, they were saying gang members are bad and these guys are gang members, so therefore they must be bad. Like, right? That's
exactly. I mean, you know, I mean, because you got to be convicted. I mean, this is what they got a gang task force member to get up there and say that you have to be convicted felon of other gang crimes and murders and robberies in order, you know what I'm saying, to be a certified gang member after they had already gotten more witnesses up there to say that we were gang members. You see what I'm saying? So basically painting this false picture to the jury to make them think that we were just some hardcore mob gang members or something, you know, that goes around shooting people. And they actually had nothing like that really in our record. We had never been convicted of anything before in our life.
Right. It's like saying some people who own guns shoot people. So if you're a gun owner, you must shoot people. Right. I mean, it's totally false, but that's what they're trying to make people believe.
Exactly. Yeah, they put it out there, and then the DA, I mean, and the judge allowed this, and then tried to come back and say, okay, well, you can't give any more questions like this, but I'm going to go ahead and let these go. And it was just like, I felt it, and I think even my public defender even, I think, was upset about that one, because it was just so blatant, and it just completely just, you know, like, gave the jury this mentality that wasn't going to be able to be broken. No matter how illogical the case itself seemed, it was like, that's all they seen, and that's all they kept pushing for, was to scare the jury into believing we were just these hardcore gang members, because after they convinced them of that, there was nothing else left for us. Like, they felt like we had to be the ones that did it, if they're saying all these things about them, you know what I mean? Like, it's, so it was some misconduct, a lot going on, I think, by the DA, you know, was slickly putting a lot of stuff in there. And then the judge, I felt like, was, you know, he wasn't overruling a lot of those objections that our attorneys were putting out there to get a lot of that stuff stricken from the record.
So, do you think that they ever answered for that, for their misconduct? Was there any kind of retribution?
I mean, I think they got a gift, basically, because, I mean, one of our public defenders after our case, he went over and became one of the assistant district attorneys up in the head office. So, I mean, probably benefited them to get rid of us. I feel like in a bigger picture, it's more about numbers than anything. Like, we got convictions, and that's going to make sure, you know, we stay in office and things like that. It's like, it's politics that are involved. And I think that we're, a lot of times, they don't really look at these people who are going through these situations as human beings, as real lives that they're taking away, you know?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that when a person's performance is based on a number of convictions rather than a number of accurate convictions, then the goal is lost, then justice is lost. Rachel, how would you say that misconduct is sanctioned in a trial?
If a judge determines that there's been misconduct at the trial, pre-trial stage or the trial stage, the judge has the option to sanction by excluding evidence basically excluding evidence. So, like, at the pretrial stage, if the police violate your constitutional rights in getting a confession or in conducting a search or a seizure, then there are motions that the defense can file before the trial to try to keep out the evidence that resulted from that action. So in the case of a confession, if the police coerce the defendant into a confession and the judge agrees that the police did in fact, you know, act inappropriately, unlawfully in getting that confession, then the judge will or should keep the confession out of the trial. And that, of course, hurts the prosecution a lot because they want to be able to have a confession. That's a key piece of state evidence. If the prosecution does not disclose evidence in the course of discovery, either before trial or during the course of trial, the defense can move to prohibit the prosecution from being able to use that evidence at trial. So that's the punishment that the prosecution gets for not complying with the discovery rules.
So, Erica, in a case like Malcolm's where it's over, is there a way to sanction someone who acted unethically during the trial now that the trial is over?
So, I think it goes state by state. So there are some cases, I was just reading about a case where a couple were convicted in the 90s having to do with where there was like this sort of hysteria, paranoia about Satanism. And this couple who were daycare workers were ended up being convicted they owned a daycare. They were being convicted. They were convicted of committing all kinds of satanic rituals based on the testimony of these children who were, the testimony was completely false. And in that particular state, they qualified, I think, for $80,000 for every year, $80,000 for every year. So depending on the state where there are wrongful convictions, sometimes there is an option to sue civilly. And then sometimes they may have, that particular state may have some sort of law in place that awards the person money. But holding an individual prosecutor who may have done something unethical is very unusual. So if you look at like the Massachusetts case, for example, where there was that chemist who falsified, I think it's somewhere in the order of I don't know, 20,000 lab reports, she's facing criminal charges. But that is very unusual. I think I've seen maybe one or two where an individual prosecutor is held, or an individual person within the state's case, be that a prosecutor, a police officer, a chemist, is held criminally liable. I think it's incredibly unusual.
I'm just going to put this out there from everybody. It just, how do we fix that? How do we fix that people can do unethical things and not be held accountable for it? How do we start? How do we even start to fix it?
I mean, I think there have to be consequences. I mean, I think it's a very difficult problem to tackle. But I think that I think the difficulty is where you don't want to catch in this net that you're, so you want to create some sort of consequence. You don't, and if we think about this consequence as a net, we don't want to catch in the net people who are mistaken. So for example, what if somebody testified falsely, but the officer or the prosecutor didn't know that it was false, or maybe they didn't vet it as well as they should, but they didn't feed somebody information. I think those, when you're looking at people sort of on the edges of the problem, that's difficult because you don't want to necessarily cast those people in the same light as you would somebody who's actively, affirmatively doing things that are illegal, improper. So like if you look at the Stephen Avery case and what Stephen Avery's lawyer is alleging, I mean, she's alleging a very coordinated, systemic falsifying of a case against him, which I think is different than one person. But I think there has to be consequences when prosecutors or anybody else steps over the line.
Does anybody have anything that they need to say that I haven't asked?
Can I ask Malcolm one question?
Yes. Does anybody have questions for Malcolm?
I do.
I have questions too. Yeah.
Okay, good. Are you okay with that, Malcolm?
Yeah, I'm cool. Totally.
Yeah, it's okay. My question's not like personal or weird or anything, but I'm just curious. did the state ever offer you a plea prior to trial?
Oh, yeah, they offered me, I think it was 25-year sentence to testify against my co-defendant and basically say that he did it. And they would give me 25 years, and he would only be the only one to get the life sentence, I guess, in trial.
And did you ever consider taking that?
I couldn't. You know what I mean? It was like, I knew that he was innocent. You know what I'm saying? Like, I knew he was innocent because he was with me. We knew that we didn't have anything to do with it. So for me, and this was my friend. You know what I mean? Like, this was my friend. We were not strangers to each other. You know, we've been knowing each other since we were kids. There's no way possible in my heart and that I could live with myself and do that to him, knowing that he was an innocent man or a kid at that time. You know what I'm saying? So, no, I couldn't consider, you know, and I even told them that. I was like, I can't do that. I mean, if you would have just offered me the 25 and said, hey, you know, you take this case and we'll give you a 25-year sentence, you know, then that could be something to consider. If you're offering me a life sentence and you say, okay, I'll give you a 25 instead. Yeah, that's something to consider. But to consider saying, give this guy the life sentence that you know is innocent and that's your friend and we'll give you the 25, I couldn't accept that.
So they tried to flip both of you on each other? They did the same thing with him?
Yeah, they did. And after – I was going to say something about that. And after I turned that down, they went to him with a 15-year sentence to do the same thing to me. Like, they cut it even lower. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that was, you know, that goes on so much. Like, that is, especially here in Oklahoma, like, that's like their main way of convicting people. Like, we'll make you a deal and you get the next guy.
Yeah, it makes their job easier.
But no, it makes their job much easier.
And I bet that's made your friendship much stronger, too.
Oh, yeah, we still friends to this day. Like, through the 20 years, you know, we always found a way to connect. Like, our mothers, we had to, you know, read a letter. My mother would read a letter from him to me over the phone. You know what I mean? So, you know, this, he's like my brother. Like, we stayed strong through this. And, you know, just like him, he was fighting on his end and I was fighting on mine. You know, we writing every day to anybody and everybody that would listen, you know, and help us. So, yeah, it definitely, you know, I mean, and to this day, and if the question was asked to me what I would feel about doing it today, I would still choose the same one thing. Knowing that that was going to be the outcome, I would still not point that finger and give him that time for something that I know he didn't do.
Good for you.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Erica, did you have a question for Malcolm?
I did have a question. So Malcolm, I was wondering, so I have some clients who are naive going into the system, like it's their first time, and they just believed that because they were innocent, they would be exonerated, you know, at the time of the trial, that at the end of the day, the truth is going to prevail. How did you believe that you were just, that it was all going to be okay because you were in fact innocent?
I mean, for a long time, I thought that way. I mean, our case is so crazy. Like, you ever, you know, look into it and you see, I mean, I was so confident because they caught the other guy who actually did it. They caught him with all the evidence, the cars, he still had the gun on him, you know, the bullets, everything. Like, he had all the physical evidence. He got caught with it. And so, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, this is open shut. We're going to be out of here as soon as all this paperwork gets done and whatever they need to do. But instead of them doing that, they dropped his charges and gave him an accessory and said, we were the ones who actually did it and allowed him to testify against us since we didn't basically want to testify on each other. They utilized him to get both of us.
He took the deal.
He got off on them. Yeah, he cut the deal and got the 5-year sentence. Yeah, he got a 5-year sentence. And he got out, and while we were still in the county, it was just a few months later, he caught another murder case.
Wow.
Where he beat a guy to death with a baseball bat at Quick Trip and robbed him and took three other guys down with him on that. They all got death penalty.
Can you tell the story about, because he, right before he was executed, he talked about you, right?
Yeah, he did. He did. Right before he got executed, you know, he told the whole story. You know, he went into an interview with the Oklahoma Innocence Project, who are the people who helped get us free, and basically told them exactly how he did it, you know, and it was, I mean, for me, it wasn't shocking because I already knew, you know what I mean? For many, many years, I knew the truth. So it just to hear it coming from his mouth was just like, hey, I told you so. Like, I've been saying this for over 20 years, you know? I mean, and it's obvious. How did this guy here, you caught him with every piece of evidence that were ever presented. We didn't have anything. We didn't get caught with any guns or anything. No murder weapon. He got caught with the murder weapon. You know, like, we didn't have fingerprints, nothing. Our entire case relied on witnesses, false witness testimony. That was our case.
Did you have faith that it was all going to come out eventually?
I had to have faith. I mean, there's been times that I had was on the verge of giving up and let go. There's been times that I was like, oh, man, how is this going to ever happen? But I had to have faith. I had to continue to fight and have that strength, inner strength in my soul. Like, because if I didn't have that and I didn't have a strong mother who was very, very, she's very deep, you know what I mean, and to her religion and life, And she always pushed me to just continue to have faith. Don't ever give up. You know what I mean? So I was blessed, you know, that I had, you know, good family to stand behind me and help me get through that situation and what it was built up in me as a child. You know, so, yeah, you know, you had to have faith because that at that point, that's all you have left. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when they hand you that type of time and they basically telling you, you're going to die in here. You know, this is where your final resting place would be, right here behind these bars. You're never going to be with your family or anybody like that ever again. You know, and so that's a hard pill to swallow for an 18-year-old kid. You know, at 17, so, you know.
Malcolm, today, right now, in this moment, how do you feel?
Oh, in this moment right now, I'm good. I feel really good, and it's exhilarating every time I get an opportunity to talk about the story, to share this with the people, for this podcast to get into the ears of somebody that can help save someone else's life. So I feel really good. I'm out here now. I'm free and enjoying life. So, yeah, it's great.
We were talking earlier about how popular you are on social media, and I was wondering if you wanted to share your social media for listeners who also want to be advocates. Did you have social media you wanted to share?
Oh yeah. I'm on everything. I'm on Facebook, Malcolm Scott, my full name. I'm on Instagram, Mr. Swagger 764. That's my Instagram. Same thing on my Snapchat. I'm on there, Twitter. So I didn't get into all that. Yeah, all my social medias are basically the same. Mr. Swagger 764. That's just all my are basically the same. I keep it simple that way I don't forget.
So Erica, I know you have a blog. Do you want to share your blog, and do you have social media contacts if people would want to talk to you more about stuff?
Sure. So the blog where I write about these kind of cases is MarylandPostConviction.com. And my Twitter handle is SuterLaw, SuterLaw.
Perfect. And Rachel, do you have any social media that you would like to share or other podcasts you would like to promote?
I heard there's this really amazing podcast called Convicted. Rumor has it that it's spellbinding and extremely well done. So check that out. And my Twitter handle is at Rachel Kamins, RachelKamins.
Thank you guys so much for being on here. I really appreciate it. You're amazing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
A special thanks to Malcolm, Erica, and Rachel for being a part of today's show. Also, thank you to our sponsors for supporting this episode. Remember, if you can't financially support our sponsors, you can still help by giving them a shout out on social media and thanking them for their support. Visit our website, ActualInPod, for more information and a calendar of our summer release dates. Check out our new podcast, Convicted, on your favorite podcast app. And you might also want to check out Cold Case Files, the podcast. You might recognize the host. Our theme song is by Andy Cohen. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice. Thanks again, and always, for listening.
This week we're discussing the case of the Grim Sleeper.
Tonight we are discussing the wrongful conviction of Richard Rosario.
We're going to talk about the disappearance of Evelyn Hernandez.
We will be discussing the case of the San Mateo Slasher.
Dive into the disappearance of Sneha Phillip.
The wrongful conviction and near execution of Clarence Bramley.
Welcome to Misconduct, a true crime podcast. I'm Eileen, and with me as always is Colleen.
Join us every Thursday as we discuss resolved and unresolved crimes, wrongful convictions, and miscarriages of justice. Find out more at misconductpodcast.com.
Hi, my name's Lucy.
And I'm Emma.
And we are from the podcast Slaughter.
It's a UK true crime podcast that looks at cases from Britain and its surrounding areas.
And we make jokes and rumble along with them.
So if you like a bit of comedy with your true crime, then give us a listen, because listening to Slaughter doesn't make you a psycho.
Killing people